Support for this program is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
The Local Thread.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to La Prensa Habla. My name is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are here to talk about mental health today. This is such an important topic that maybe we don't talk about enough. And I'm really excited to dive into it. We have two guests here. We typically have our guests introduce themselves. So Maria and Louis, we'll start with Maria. Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Maria Alvarez. I used to be Jimena Alvarez. So That's my middle name. But when I came here, it was very difficult for people like to recognize, you know, the spelling and everything. So I'm from Colombia. I've been here for 11 years already. I came here because my husband was transferred from his job. I was a psychologist there. But as soon as I got here, so I kind of like needed to validate my credentials. So I wait a little bit and got a certification as a life coach, and I work doing like sessions as a life coach in between 6-7 years. And then as soon as I got a better level of English and I was able to go, as in an international student to the university, I got my master's degree as a clinical mental health counselor. And I've been working as a counselor almost 3 years already.
That's such an amazing journey. And we'll dive into it a little bit more after we hear from Louis. Can you tell us about yourself, Louis?
Yes. My name is Louis Guardiola. I'm from Northwest Ohio, born and raised here in the Northwest Ohio area. In a small town, I grew up in Gibsonburg, Ohio, and then we moved to Fremont, Ohio, which was not much of a bigger town, but and so I had a lot of extended family growing up, and I was the first one to go to undergraduate school, graduate with my bachelor's in social work, and then I was the first one in both sides of the family to graduate with a master's. I have a master's in social work, and my concentration as a professional has been psychiatric social work as well as cultural diversity training, specifically focusing on the Latino community's needs in terms of mental health disparities in our community.
You know, this is an exciting episode, and I'm really excited because I'm not a big believer in mental health, you know. So I guess I want to ask you guys. First of all, you know, and sometimes as humans, we don't believe in what we don't understand, right? So let's start with the history of mental health. You know, what can you guys tell us a little bit about the history of mental health?
I don't know if it has a history like America has a history.
So where do you guys know where how it began, or how long we've been talking about mental health?
Well, I think as Jessica mentioned, you know, mental health has been part of the what we look at holistically with someone in terms of their physical health, their mental health, all of that holistically working together to ensure that, you know, that you have a good well-being. I think for the Latino community, it's been more of a challenge because of the fact that some of our protective factors, some of the things within our culture that help us with dealing with traumas, dealing with, you know, the migration patterns that we've had to deal with. You know, I think the community has banded together as a group, you know, extended family, even though you're not blood, you just, you know, support each other. I think that's those protective factors have been helpful for the resiliency. But then I think what you're alluding to is in terms of some of the more like mental health illnesses like schizophrenia, depression, and those type of things that I think that have been some stigma in the community. And so I think that more of the natural support systems like the spirituality, the churches and things have historically dealt with it. But there is a need for more higher level interventions, especially when you deal with illnesses like schizophrenia and things that need medications. But, you know, I don't know. Maria, what are your thoughts?
Yes, and actually, I was kind of like, it was interesting to listen, like, I don't believe in mental health.
I know.
What that means, you know? Are you a believer or not?
and I guess I ask that because it seems like mental health has been more of a topic the last 10 years than it has the last, 50 years, right? If you look at 50 years, were they really talking about mental health? But now it's like it's being shoved down everybody's throat, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess when I say, like, I don't necessarily believe in it, there's a fine line between what real mental health is and what mental health being used as a scapegoat, mm-hmm. right? Or like, oh, I'm just the victim of maybe something that isn't necessarily attached to mental health versus, like you said, someone with schizophrenia.
Right.
Yeah.
That's real mental health.
Right. And I think this has to do something with the potential of health that everyone has. So sometimes we just live our lives with our own histories, personalities, our own families, cultures, and everything. And it looks like everything is so natural. It is what it is, This is how I am, This is how I was raised, and this is how I'm going to die, being in this way. And for me, it's more like the potential that you have to change, And that's why it's very important, the mental health, because when you understand that there is something that you can work on, that there is something that is related with the connection between body, emotions, and mind, and how this can affect in a positive or in a negative way in your life, is when you are going to start believing in mental health and trying to understand how are you, what is it that you need to do in order to be better, the potential that you have in health.
Is it maybe like therapy? Is it therapy that you don't believe in or that you don't yet understand, like, why it's a common practice?
No, I think it just kind of boils down to, if I were to tell my mom or if I were to tell my grandma, I'm depressed, As Latinos, she would laugh at me. Right? She would be like, oh, you're depressed.
There is now actually a show that a comedian is bringing this topic. And it is like, everyone was thinking that I have ADD.
ADHD, yes.
ADHD. and I can perceive that I have ADHD, and why not? But then I told my mom, and my mom says, no, you don't. So I don't have it. So yeah, exactly. It's that kind of like a stigma that you were talking about in our Hispanic culture, and it is more like we have to find the strength within our family, the support system, and it is so hard to go outside and ask for help outside.
Mm-hmm. And I think that obviously, if we were in a therapy session and you brought that up, I would explore where you would be at in terms of, what do you think your issues are? Or what do you, because I think that sometimes there might be some gender differences where Latino men feel like they need to be stable, they can't express emotion. Mm. And some of those, if you are, if you hang on to those belief systems or those are your belief systems, then yes, you're going to see that, you have to focus on work and that comes first. And unfortunately, then our behavioral health and our medical health come last because we want to focus on. And again, it goes with socioeconomic status. If someone is trying to, make ends meet and they don't have time to seek therapy or they can't afford it. And then that's where those protective factors come in. And they can help, but I think that if it leads to chronic depression where it becomes something that you can no longer deal with by changing behaviors or doing self-care. I like the term self-care because it's not as stigmatizing in terms of getting mental health treatment, taking care of yourself, right? Just like you would, I try to reframe it like you would your car. You do all the preventative maintenance. You do all the things you need to do for, to make sure that it's going. We need to do the self-care, not only for our medical, making sure that our diets, et cetera, but also that we are not stressed and we manage our stress, that we do exercise, things that will help our well-being as a whole.
Do you guys think the Latino community in general, do you guys think we're a problem-solving community?
We are so strong with family, traditions, faith, and community. Mm. So yes, definitely. And actually, that's one of the challenges that we face when we got here, because here the culture, the acculturation process, it's very difficult for us. And we need to face that process, that it is coming from our cultures and trying to deal with this new culture, which is bringing to us as well beautiful things, but it's kind of like this confusion that we are going through for a little bit, and it is kind of like trying to get our new identity, because at the end of the day, we are not there anymore, but we will never be completely from here. We always were going to be like foreigners from here, you know? So it's kind of like trying to understand which is our in-between identity.
No soy de aquí ni de allá.
Something in between. Something in between.
There was, if you looked at, if you saw the movie Selena, there was a part in that movie where Selena says to her dad, "Where I'm not good enough to be Mexican, but I'm not good enough to be American. I'm in the middle." And there have been studies out there that said people from Mexico have a higher self-esteem and a higher self-worth than Mexican people in the United States because of those the assimilation and all those things, and removing them from some of the cultural norms that they were familiar with, that it causes them to not fit in, and the discrimination and in the Selena movie was discrimination from Mexican people saying, "Well, you don't speak Spanish good enough or well enough, etc." And then the Americans are saying, "Well, you have an accent, and you're not fitting in." So for mental health therapists, you know, we just don't take, you know, you clearly look Hispanic, right? And so I would want to explore with you what level of assimilation, acculturation you are, because if you just, you know, I hang on to the values of your culture, then I need to say, okay, what are some of the things that you feel caused your illness? And we just had a Latino forum where we brought a group of professionals together in October, where we had a priest and a holistic nurse be part of that, because I think it's important for those individuals to, you know, if people seek services from spirituality, then that, if that minister or priest is able to then refer that individual to a clinician, and giving that, they have that authority to say, "Oh, maybe it's good for you to see Luis Guardiola, you know, to see if he can help you with those issues, because, you know, I can help you with this, but I can't do that." So that helps push the folks to reduce that stigma and have permission to address any mental health issues they might have.
I have a question for the three of you, but I want to start with Jessica, because she hasn't really said much, but do you think modern mental health culture sometimes teaches people to identify as victims instead of problem solvers?
I think that it would be easy for somebody who doesn't believe in mental health to think that somebody who's going to therapy feels like a victim. And I will say that I have gone to therapy many times in my life. I've done things like internal family systems. I've done cognitive behavioral therapy. And quite honestly, I think those are probably the times in my life where I've felt most powerful and most empowered, because there's a sense of self and a sense of liberation when you realize that what you have going on inside of you is completely yours to grow and to flourish, and that outside factors don't really affect that. So I can understand why people think that. I think a victim mentality exists in our society, but I mean, there's a difference between "I can't do that, I have depression," or "I can't do that, I'm anxious," or there's somebody who you know, feels that anxiety and channels it in another way, like to go rock climbing, for example. So I can understand why somebody would feel like the victim mentality exists, but.
And actually the struggles are real, and the difference in between genders as well. So for example, women are more prone to ask to go to therapy than men. And no wonder why every 4 men out of 10 deal with suicidal ideation at some point in their life. And it is because they think that they need to deal with this just by their own. And they need to understand as well how to manage emotions, learn more about emotions, how to express emotions, how to understand others' emotions and validate emotions and all of that. And just until that point, they're going to be able to process them, you know. So when actually women are more prone to go to therapy, but they are more prone to self-harm by alcohol or drugs or other not healthy coping mechanisms as well. But I think the struggle is real.
Yeah, I think that, again, it lends to the if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, right? You know, the first stage is making sure you have all your needs met first. And so for some of our families, they are in poverty, and so they don't have the time to focus on some of these red flags that they might see with mental health issues. And, you know, you there's that the humor about, what are you in Spanish, it's like you're depressed. No, if you're depressed, ponte a trabajar. Here's the broom, you know, sweep, get depressed. Ni que nada, you know.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, so, and that's part of that whole thing of, you know, that we've had to be as a culture, you know, be very strong, but yet we can only do it in terms of when we live in this bicultural society with all the stimuli. You know, I think that you mentioned about what you mentioned about females. I think that there were studies that say teenage girls in high school have a higher rate of attempting suicide and actually committing suicide than when you look at their African American and American counterparts. So, you know, again, maybe, you know, is the issue that they're not getting the assessments, or people are not identifying those red flags. But I think that's the whole purpose. And this is wonderful that you know, brought this topic up, because I think it is an important thing to at least have a plática, a conversation about, you know, I'm not going to encourage you to, you know, just to think, if you can leave with an aha moment that, well, maybe it may not be so bad. You know, that's an accomplishment to help reduce the stigma.
On our second segment, I want to talk about a couple of things that you've said and you've said as well, Maria. You know, one is what Maria said earlier kind of reminded me, you know, everybody perceives life differently, right? And it reminds me of a Spanish saying, cada cabeza es un mundo. And I want to talk about what you just said. You know, there's people that, like me, like I grew up in poverty. I didn't have time to think about, oh, you know, I'm depressed, right? You die of hunger if you're depressed. So we'll talk about that on our second segment. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to our second segment. This is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are here with Louie and Maria, two mental health professionals. And if you listen to our first segment, you heard that we have quite an array of viewpoints here about mental health. So, Kevin, you had mentioned that there was a saying you wanted to dig into.
Yeah, cada cabeza es un mundo. Luis, can you explain to us what that means?
I think interpreting that is that everybody's going to come in with their worldview, the way they see the world through their lens of whatever is, you know, whatever their frame of reference is. So, you know, if someone is very conservative, they're going to look at the lens through that eye, despite the facts that might show differently. And so that's where I'm interpreting that saying is that, you know, and so we have to approach it as behavioral health and medical people, because I know we're talking about mental health and the disparities in the Latino community in terms of seeking mental health and reducing depression and all those other symptoms that come with that, but also medical health, you know, in terms of, you know, ensuring that the community is doing, the Latino community is getting access to the different services, preventative health, et cetera. But you know, maybe economically, or maybe they may not believe that, you know, I'm fine, or there might be some stigmas that are universal, like, you know, men that don't get colonoscopies because of whatever stigma they have. Mm-hmm. And all those barriers get in the way of trying to get the best for their well-being. And so programs like this and other programs throughout the community here in Lucas County are trying to help reduce those barriers and improve people's willingness to at least, you know, talk about it a little bit and see, you know, improve their well-being.
Kevin, is your thought process that if somebody goes to therapy and they are diagnosed as depressed or anxious, that they will be stuck there always?
No, I just think they're maybe thinking about it too much, possibly. About, you know, I'm depressed. And I feel like mentally, if I sit here and tell myself I'm depressed, right, I'm going to make myself depressed. Eventually, over time, I'm going to make my – if I tell myself, oh, I have mental issues, I have mental health issues, and over time, I actually will, because you're speaking that into existence. You know, my mom would always say, no digamos que somos pobres. Let's not say we're poor. Let's not say, you know, because mentally, you're rich, right? And if you're rich mentally, that will come out with your actions, your decisions, who you are, how you approach life, you know. And so that's why I'm like, you know, I wouldn't sit here and say, oh, I'm depressed, because I feel like I would just put myself down.
I think that's going to work for some, but not for everyone. And we as professionals, I think that we can catch that in therapy, and we can perceive when the struggle is real, you know. And again, it's more about the potential that they have to be better. And sometimes it's not just mindset. Sometimes it's something that has to do with their belief system. And we work on changing that, kind of like reframing those beliefs and why not. But sometimes it's even biologically. Something is, you know, happening, and they need to be even referred to for pharmacology management as well. So I think that depends on each case and that mindset that we usually as Hispanics do, you know, like, let's go, yeah. You know, like goalkeeper and like, eche para adelante, no? Vamos sí, sí, pa'lante, sí. Siempre pa'lante. Mm-hmm. So that has to do with our culture, and it is good until certain extent, and it's not going to work for everyone, just for some. So if maybe they are going to end up coming to our counseling room, we're going to be able to identify that and to help them.
It reminds me of, like, in the world of education, we have different tiers, right? Tier one, tier two, tier three. Think about the snow level emergencies, 1, 2, 3, right? When you get to tier three, or level three, you might be in therapy and doing something, but any individual can flow through those different levels throughout their life. There can be times where you're going to therapy regularly, times where maybe you cut back and you don't need it anymore, and then you end up back in therapy.
Yeah, the term, and I think this is what you're describing that people experience. We have situational depression, right? There's some things that happen to us. We have a loss. We have someone passes away. And then we bounce back. If we're doing everything we need to do, we have our support system. But sometimes when we experience too many external stimuli that cause us to have, you know, losses, you know, back to back, or, you know, loss of a job, loss of this, then that situational depression, if you're not, you know, on top of it, can turn into what we call a depression where you might need to seek talk therapy, or even to the point that you might need to have some antidepressants to help you through that, to get you back to, you know, homeostasis, to a level that you're comfortable in. And I think that's the challenge that any community has. But with the Latino community, there's so many barriers to address those issues. Not a lot of education, because maybe the language, you know, how, you know, maybe people speak primarily Spanish and they don't have that education to help them, you know, understand that there is a mental health center down the road, that they can talk to their physician about these things and not be termed soy loco, I'm crazy. You know, or, you know, oh, you're just suffering from nerves. You know, a lot of that growing up, you know, I would hear that a lot, that they would just bundle that under nerves, when it really, now that I look back at it, it wasn't nerves. It was either there was some issues there. But you try to, you put a container so you can move on to the other things in life that maybe are, you know, more pressing. And so those things don't get addressed.
You may want to be aware of the signs of alarm as well. So maybe that kind of like mindset that we have at home with our culture, it's going to help us to move on, you know, and to mm-hmm. progress and to be resilient. We are very resilient. But at the same time, you may want to see if maybe people around you or even yourself, you're changing behaviors or you are dealing with symptoms of depression, like you don't want to leave home, like isolation, suicidal ideation, or even stress levels or anxiety levels when it is not manageable, you know, when it's out of control.
So I'm working on a grant right now on sexual assault, and all these things intersect with each other in terms of these issues. So you think, you know, well, how does sexual assault fit into mental health? But a lot of those issues are related to that. And the stigma, even with that particular topic of the intimacy being said that it's keep it in the family, don't talk about it. And so then folks don't see that they're being violated and that right. they shouldn't have to be experiencing those things. And that's what this grant is doing, is trying to go out and educate and do the awareness that there are the YWCA, et cetera, facilities that will help with those issues.
You know, there's lots of Latinos who don't even go to the hospital, right? I'm one of them. What's the first step to seek mental health? Like, what do you do? Who do you call? Who do you reach out to?
Well, I think there could be different avenues. Obviously, one would be, I think I had done some research when I first started the Confianza Project back in the mid-90s for the Lucas County Mental Health Board. And one of the things that I tried to do to reduce the stigma is try to incorporate your medical doctor to encourage you to go into the seeking treatment. But the thing is, it's reaching out. You can call a crisis line, a helpline, to get help. Obviously, if you have a church or et cetera, you can reach out and then they would refer you out to get services. I think the challenges are the fact that people may not have insurance. And so those are things that prevent people from seeking help because they feel like they can't afford it. But the Lucas County, the Mental Health and Addictions Services Board, they do provide funding for services here for Lucas County residents, and they don't take into account anything related to citizenship or et cetera. People get those services. I think that is the mechanism here. You can either call 211 and they will also give you information about mental health agencies and services.
I think you can do a quick Google search, right? I got Maria's name through a friend, but before I was able to talk to that friend, I also saw her in a Google search. So that's also help out there.
And it's awesome that now we have teletherapy right. as well. So you will find some professionals as well doing like virtual sessions. If it is difficult for you to leave home, or if it is difficult for you to find a bilingual professional around in the area because the access is limited. Mm-hmm. So the barrier is there. So it's awesome that now we are doing a lot of things like virtually.
And it is really hard. I mean, I hope not to give too much TMI here on this show, but there was a point in time where I was on anxiety. I was taking medicine for anxiety, and I remember talking to my doctor. And it was the first time that I was going, and she said, okay, we have two different types. We have the type that you can take, you know, when you need it, as needed, and, you know, so maybe things will pop up and you need it. Or we have the type that you take every day because you just feel like you need it every day. And I was like, oh, I need it every day. Like, I can't take the one type. But that hit me so hard, and it is so hard to accept that help that you need.
You know how I look at anxiety? Some people will reach out to me and, oh, you know, I'm stressed about this or whatever. And I always tell them, look, what's meant to happen will happen, right? And for me, like, I honestly have never had anxiety because that's how I look at life. I'm like, you know, if it's meant to happen, it's going to happen. And you know, but you, like you said, Maria, it works for some people it doesn't work for. Mm-hmm.
You might be one of those tier one people. You don't need it right now in your life, Kevin.
Or you may be doing some things that fall under self-care that are mitigating those things getting out of control. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I did a self-care group with community health workers because we're looking at retaining them in the field and because they deal with a lot of trauma and then they get out of the helping profession. And part of that is, you know, are you exercising? Are you eating right? So that you don't get to the stage of burnout. You know, we all have to do that measurement in our employment, right? You know, we don't want to get to the point where we're going to burn out and then we just say, I'm just going to quit and stop. And so, but what do you need to do to manage your self-care like you would any other aspects of your life, of meditation, of exercise, of listening to self-care podcast information like this that might be helpful? So maybe you're doing some things, you're just not aware that you are doing self-care, which I think is probably what's happening. And good, it's working for you, as right. Maria mentioned. But there's some people that experience too much stimuli, too many things that cause them to get off balance, that may need more talk therapy or may need, as Jessica mentioned, some psychopharmacological interventions, medications to help them, you know, maybe not permanently, but maybe just to cut that edge for a bit, and then talk therapy can take over. But the stigma is, that's the biggest thing, and the lack of bilingual therapists is a big issue here in Lucas County. So I've been an advocate trying to do these things of encouraging the Latinos in the community to seek therapy, but I also have to manage that with the fact that if I get them to the point like you, let's say if you only spoke Spanish and you're having your thoughts about mental health, and then you decide, oh yeah, I'm gonna try this, and then you knock on the door of the mental health agency and they no hablo español.
Right.
And so you're gonna be like, well, there you go, see? Well, yeah, why am I gonna do this?
Yeah.
So this is the challenge that our community is going through with the loss of Adelante, with some of the changes in some of our community agencies, the paraprofessionals, and not just all about us as professionals. There's some wonderful paraprofessionals in the community that can be navigators, that can connect people and can maybe do those, you know, support stuff that may not lead to full-blown mental health crises.
Yes, and I think that talking about self-care and protector factors, it is important for us as Hispanic to understand that it is very important, the family, community, faith. So, for example, for us, self-care could be being around our friends, you know, and maybe video call our family, extended family in our hometown. Or music, for example, is very important for us.
Yes.
So that's elevating our, you know, mood, and we're going to feel different. So we need to do something, those things that are very important for us, but kind of like with intention, because you are not going to find them like natural here, because maybe are not part of the cultures here. So you have to put intention, you have to reach out, you have to go and try to do something with your friends, community, something about spirituality, because faith is not just related with religion, but spirituality, music, traditions. Sometimes we miss our traditions because we are not around the people, or we don't have the same resources. So why not is put intention there and bring our own traditions in our own way, but to trespass that to our next generation as well, for example.
Yeah, because we don't want folks to using the self-care so that they don't use other mechanisms that it's only going to exacerbate the situation, like using alcohol or drugs to replace that, right? And so we want to make sure that they have these other avenues so that they don't open up another can of worms of now having depression, but also having another diagnosis of substance use disorder.
I don't even think it's substance, drugs, and alcohol. I think now it's like any distraction that we overindulge in. So it could be social media, it can be food. There are so many distractors that cover or hide the things that are really killing us inside.
We're trying to be productive all the time and do something all the time and maintain, you know, keep us busy with everything. And it's, that could be as well.
There are so many people I know who can't sit still because their thoughts are, there's too many thoughts. They're taking over. They're reoccurring. They're going in cycles. That's a sign.
Yep.
Here in our next segment, we're going to talk about food and maybe how mental health, you know, how it intertwines with what we eat. But I do have one question to end the segment. What does success in mental health look like? Do you like beat it? Is it like, okay, I'm done, I won? Like, you know, is there an ending, I guess, to or do you have to just go to therapy forever?
I think of it as kind of like physical health, right? You want to maintain being healthy. You can look at somebody and can tell if they're physically healthy or not, or maybe you can't because it's something invisible.
Or it's a collaboration between the client and the therapist to say, okay, you've achieved these goals and these outcomes. why don't you fly, you know, go out there and try it. Mm-hmm. And I'm always here. If we need to, you need to come back and we can, you know, we can, you know, beef up things and then go back again. There are going to be some illnesses that require longer term interventions, mm-hmm. right? And those usually are the more chronic mental illnesses. But for the most part, we want to, you know, want people to go out and practice and be, individuate themselves and do the things they need to do now that they're educated on recognizing the signs and symptoms of either the depression, the anxiety, et cetera, so that they can seek therapy.
And I usually try to teach them how to fish instead of give them the fish. Right. Mm.
And I can say I've already shared so much. That's happened to me before. I've been going to therapy, and then I graduated from therapy, and then there was a different part of my life where I felt like maybe I should go back. You know, that really helped me during that time. And those conversations ended up being like, how do I access my highest self? You know, so there might have been a point in time where I wasn't struggling every day, but there's this licensed professional who can help me tap into another level, and why not?
Why or not a take support advantage? Group replaces yes. it, right? That you may not see formal therapy, but you might be involved with some support group that'll help you. Or you go to the gym and you establish friends there that'll mm-hmm. help. And those folks are more eyes and ears on, you seem a little different, right? And then, or you seem, you know, and then that'll cue you into, maybe I need to go see Maria again and make mm-hmm. an appointment.
And I think that this has been a shift in between being proactive instead of corrective. Yeah. So coming now, people are coming to therapy in order to prevent something else mm-hmm. instead of correct something that is already happening.
So we've discussed some coping mechanisms like the gym. And as Latinos, we love music. We love música. So I'm sure, I use it as therapy, honestly. The gym, music, and last one that we're going to jump into next segment is going to be food. But, you know, we do have to take a break. So we'll be back for my favorite segment, the food segment. Welcome back to La Prensa Habla. My name is Kevin Salinas, and I am here with Adrián Rodela, who brought some delicious enchiladas. I am here with Maria Alvarez and Luis Guardiola. So, Adrián, can you tell us what you brought for us here today?
We've always called them enchiladas growing up, but from what I've heard from a lot of other people, it's more of a wet burrito. A real enchilada is supposed to be made with corn tortillas. But we've called them enchiladas my whole life, but they're off of a flour tortilla.
You say there's
it's a chicken mole gravy that the tortillas are dipped in, and the gravy is made from scratch. I mean, flour, seasonings, it's literally from scratch, the mole gravy.
So you say you have been calling them enchiladas your whole life. So
yeah,
is this a family recipe?
Yeah. Yes, my grandmother. She's made them my entire life. I mean, she's really, really good with the Mexican food. The beans were made from scratch. The rice was made from scratch. Everything was made right in front of on the stove.
Adrián, so can you tell us a little bit about your background? Are you from Toledo area? Where's your family from?
Born and raised, Toledo, Ohio.
And your family is from Mexico?
No. All my family's from Genoa, Ohio. I have a lot of family from San Antonio down there. But all my immediate family and my grandparents, everybody's was from up here in Toledo.
So tell us about this recipe. I know you said you made everything from scratch, but a lot of times, you know, the listeners like to hear exactly how to make it so that they might be able to replicate it at home. So can you tell us, you know, to finish, what goes into this?
Well, get ready. Here it is.
Pen's ready.
Green pepper, onion, comino, chili powder, garlic, salt, and pepper. 10 pounds of meat we made. And then the gravy was made from, trying to think, 4 cups of oil, 1/2 cup of chili powder, 1/2 cup of cumino, salt, pepper, and then stir over low heat until thickens, and keep adding water. Keep adding water, it's gonna thicken up.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever used other types of meats, or what type of meat is
ground beef? Ground beef is what we use. I've had other families and other family members, we've done it with chicken.
Yeah.
With shredded chicken also. I've only ever done them with the hamburger meat. So 5 pounds of cheese.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, it was the big block. It was like a 2-foot-long block of cheese. That's pretty much most that goes into it. And then you got your beans, the, you know, 4 cups of beans, 4 cups of water, bacon, 1/2 pound of bacon in the beans, garlic, chili powder. I'm trying to go through everything. Doggone it.
It's probably a little bit of everything, right? Mm-hmm. When you're making this, is it something that you measure out specifically, or do you just know it by heart at this point?
Mom keeps everything by the measurement.
Okay.
I'm better when I do things by the hand, by eye.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way my grandmother had taught. She would, her measurements were the center of the palm of the hand. And that was, you know, that was a tablespoon, and, you know, it's just, and to smell and to seasoning, you know, that it was always strong with the garlic, and I backed it off. I backed off the garlic, so they are very good, though. You like them?
Yep. It's delicious.
Thank Maria, you. I actually had a question for you. You're from Colombia. Is there enchiladas in Colombia?
No, actually, I think that the only time that I got enchiladas in Colombia is from a Mexican restaurant. But I do have some ingredients from here, from this dish, that remind me my childhood, you know, my home. And, for example, the rice, we always, in the same way that Mexicans need to have all the time tortillas for everything, all the time, is the same from Colombia with rice. So we combine, like, mix the rice with meat or chicken, or why not salad sometimes, the protein and vegetable, rice. Every time, rice. If there is not rice, there is not a dish, you know, at home.
That's right.
Beans. We have a very popular dish in Colombia, which is called bandeja paisa. And it's made by beans, a lot of things as well, like rice, chorizo, eggs, avocado, I don't know, I'm forgetting something else. Meat, like ground meat as well, beef. Mm-hmm. And so that reminds me as well, like something from Colombia.
Do you guys have a plate that's similar to this one? To how the enchilada looks?
Like, not really. The other thing that I was thinking about the tortilla is the arepa. And you already maybe know the debate about the arepa between Colombians and Venezuelans.
What was that again?
Arepa.
What is arepa?
Arepa is made with corn as well. And we have like different kinds of arepas in Colombia. And so depending on the region that you are at, you will find different arepas.
You know, I was going to ask you because I've heard about arepas before. I don't know that I've ever had one, but I didn't know if it was just a Venezuelan thing.
Yeah, so we're kind of like debating if they are the ones who brought it or not or created it first. The good thing is that it's unique in each country, and they have their own arepa in their own way, and we have our own as well, and that's what's making us like unique and very rich in culture, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've had a debate on this show before about where a food originated from, and I think we...
Pupusas.
Pupusas. Yeah. Natalie ended up winning that debate. So you said that everybody probably knows the debate between the... What is the debate? Because I don't think our listeners do know.
Correct. That who... Where is the arepa coming from first? You know, which was the origin of the arepa?
And where do you think it originated from?
I don't know. And the more that I...
You're not going to take responsibility for that.
No. I don't want to. No, and I've been trying to, make my own research and why not. But I didn't have any luck with it, because people that are defending... that are from Colombia, are Colombians. Mm-hmm. People that are defending that are from Venezuela, are from, from Venezuela.
So you're recognizing your bias.
Yeah, I am.
Louis, what does this, what does the enchilada remind you of?
Well, actually, I think being Mexican, so that I'm very familiar with this and I'm very familiar with the ingredients. I think that, everybody wants to own their specialty. And I think it's like all cultures, it brings you back to your mom, your grandmother, passing down the ingredients and the way folks make it. And even with Mexicanos, with Mexican folks, they make it different. Like enchiladas, my cousin who married someone from Mexico, the enchilada was, I was like really excited because I was thinking about the hamburger meat, all the stuff that I had in my head about an enchilada. And it was queso cheese with onion. And then it was fried in the chili powder. And that was the enchilada, which was... probably what he grew up with, right? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I think that it food is a culture universal, right? Every culture has it. It brings happiness and warmth and memories. And, I think that I've always been one that I asked my mom, I want to make it. I want to do this, So I learned, she taught me, and it was that. It's like, Mom, but is it a teaspoon? No. Pone un poquito. Put a little bit of this. Okay. And it was basically when I was caregiving, babysitting for my nieces and nephew. There was like five of them, and so I wanted to give them something different, than just the pizza that my cousins would get for them for supper while they worked. And so that was where I had my mom teach me, and so they were my guinea pigs. In terms of my working on improving my cooking skills, but those are memories. I mean, that's I'm 64 and I was 15 when I was doing that, and I still recall, and they were happy. They was giving them some of their culture, right? In terms of food, and it also helped me appreciate. Back then, I think as later on, I saw the movie like Water for Chocolate. They talked about the ingredients of the foods, et cetera. And so it was interesting to kind of connect the dots in terms of how folks grow up with food. It was mostly close to, my mom was the second of nine children. And so my mother and her oldest sister had to cook for the other children. Mm-hmm. So they learned how to make tortillas at nine. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of, that you just did that. And I just appreciate that I didn't, that I paid attention to that and that I incorporated that into. And now my mother has passed away. And so I'm the one that my nieces and my brothers and my sisters say, oh, are you going to make arroz con pollo? Aww. Because it's the closest to my mother's. And although I'm my own self-critic.
Have you written down the recipe ever, or is it still something that you measure by hand?
I have, because I had to, because my nieces are like, Uncle Louis, how do you do this, and so I had to force myself to sit down and quantify, okay, I'll experiment. So this is a teaspoon, and then, okay, did that come out, so then I would adjust it. So, yeah, I ended up coming up with a recipe that I've handed down.
Is enchiladas, is it a very common dish, do you eat it every day? Is it something that you only cook when things are a little bit better, or is it pretty common?
I think that that's a great question. I think depending, obviously folks are, depending on their income, they're challenging, frijoles and arroz are the staples that, that one has with blanquillos, with eggs. I think enchiladas are maybe kind of like the main culture. You have them once, like meatloaf, you have once a week, you know, as a meal. I think that depending on whether or not you can, it might change if you have the ability to afford the hamburger meat or whatever, then you do it. Or if you don't, then you just use it with cheese and the corn tortillas. So, again, depending on individual socioeconomic situation, you know, sometimes those things can drive what you have, which then leads to the whole issue of our diets as Latino community, that we need to monitor our intake of certain, fats and et cetera. But I think in moderation, one can enjoy one's cultural food.
That does remind me of, you know, our topic of mental health. Where, Maria and Louis, where do you think food fits into that? You know, is it a factor of our mental health? Is it not? Does it pose itself as therapy in a good way, in a bad way? You know, what are your thoughts?
It makes you happy.
Yeah, and absolutely, it's a connection with your culture.
Right.
Mm. And actually, people who are coming from other countries that they don't have the opportunity to get here, the recipes, the restaurants, the ingredients, it's difficult to bring back those kind of like memories. So of course it has to be like, it has to do with like recovering like the memories and get that connection with our own home and culture. And every time
I bet. Nostalgic.
Yeah, nostalgic. Yeah, of course. And I was going to that point. And every time that we have the opportunity to get it, for example, for us as Colombians, we are 5 hours away from our Colombian restaurant. In Cleveland, they're supposed to have a Colombian restaurant, but it's not similar, like quite similar.
You know the real thing.
Difference, yeah. So I think it is in Chicago, you know? So it's 5 hours away. So every time that my family is coming, they are bringing some ingredients or they are coming to cook for us. And that connection is very powerful.
Have you found anything around here that resembles something from home for you?
The closest I will say, maybe it's Cuban, because they have tostones, plantains, maduros, which are the sweetest, rice, like white rice, beef, something similar, some vegetables, something similar, but not quite similar.
I think the preparation of the food, you know, for instance, you know, we just had the Christmas holiday and making the tamales where the family gets together. You know, not want to be sexist, but it's been mostly the women, but they're, you know, we're men, and we're starting to get our hands in the masa, into the flour. And, you know, that brings that, you know, community, the sharing, and again, memories, and the, you know, you think of aromatherapy, right? Folks that have that, I mean, food and the smells bring those things and elicit some comfort, right? Like people call comfort food. So some of those things are important. And again, as I mentioned earlier, culture universals, every culture, it has the same, right? It elicits the same feelings. And
Adrian, were you going to say something?
I make the meat for the tamales. Yeah, the women do the women do the what do they call it when they spread them?
Oh, that, yeah.
Empachao, or I don't know how they when they spread the masa, but the meat is mine. Yeah.
Here's a fun fact. In Honduras, enchiladas are more like Mexican tostadas. So it's a deep fried tortilla, and you put ground beef on it, and then you put salad, like a sauce on top of it. So we don't really have anything that I could look at a Mexican enchilada and say we have something similar. But our enchiladas are completely different than the Mexican enchiladas.
What nationality are you again?
From Honduras.
Honduras, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. But we also we cook lots of plantain, very similar to the Caribbean, South America. Puerto Rico, exactly. Yep, exactly. Yep.
What was the name of the one plantain you said? I have nephews that are Puerto Rican.
Tostones.
And he was talking about the different kinds of the their bananas, right?
Yeah.
But you said one that was he had said the name before.
Tostón.
Tostón, is that what it is? There's a sweeter one, and then there's more of a... Maduro. That one. That was the word I was looking for.
The sweet one.
Because I am going to try those. I've been hearing about them, and I've never had them. Delicious. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make them.
Maduro como el presidente.
Now, I never had the mole enchiladas until I worked for a company that the corporate office was in Laredo in Texas. And when I went there to a restaurant, and it was, you know, it was a very simple restaurant. And I'm like, oh, I'll try these. And I was like, oh, gee, this is delicious. So, so even within our own Mexican group, we have different diverse ways and styles of enhancing our foods.
And Adrián, this enchilada is really, really delicious. So thank you very much for bringing it in.
You're Maria, welcome. I'm glad to bring it.
For sure. Maria and Luis, muchas gracias. Thank you guys for being on our show. And, you know, we do have to wrap up. So thank you guys for joining us. And we'll see you guys next week on the next La Prensa Habla.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.
The views and opinions expressed in The Local Thread are those of the hosts of the program and its guests. They do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WGTE Public Media.